we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, January the 26th, 2018. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I am joined here today by our guest co-host and control room operator, Jody Pongratz of Sound Resistance. Welcome, Jody.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on today.
Yes. So on today's show, we have two interviews for you that our co-hosts Jen Dobell and Amir Ali have put together. It's time to put pressure again on the city of Victoria with regards to the horrible horse-drawn carriages that are a customary attraction in our capital city. We welcome back Jordan Reichart to the show to give us an update on the campaign to end horse-drawn carriages in Victoria. Jordan is the West Coast Campaign Officer for the Animal Protection Party and involved in the group Ban Victoria Horse Carriages, and Amir spoke with him earlier this week. Then for our second interview, Jen welcomes Rob Carruthers to the show. As our regular listeners will know, Jen engages in online dating as a way to meet people and educate them on animal rights issues. Well, she met Rob recently on Tinder, and then she met him in person a few weeks ago, as did I as well. And guess what? Rob's already vegan. So no education to be had there. He knows it all. So in this interview, she'll be speaking to him about living the life as a single vegan father of three. That interview is coming up in about 31 minutes, so please do stay tuned. So last Sunday, about 40 animal advocates gathered together at twilight at Robson Square in downtown Vancouver to be part of a demonstration to raise awareness of the cruelties of Canada Goose jackets. Canada Goose is perhaps the most prevalent brand of high-end jacket seen here on a frequent basis in Vancouver, and every time I see a coyote fur trim, I want to scream as the coyote would if you could hear her cries. So we have an audio clip here that we're going to play with some of the information that was relayed to the public at the event last week. Go ahead, Jody.
The truth is Canada Goose is a cold and callous company that uses fur trim from coyotes and feathers from abused geese. The coyotes are caught in barbaric leg traps where they suffer for days from frostbite, gangrene, blood loss, dehydration, shock, and attacks by predators, only to be shot, strangled, bludgeoned, stomped on to death. Many are mothers who were looking for food and struggled desperately to get back to their pups who are doomed to die without her. These mothers are so devoted, they will even gnaw their own legs off in a desperate attempt to get back to them. Once they are dead, they are skinned and discarded like trash. Their fur is then used by the despicable Canada Goose Company to sew onto their hoods as trim. It is as cruel as it is ugly. For those of you wearing coyote fur trim, did you know that wolves, coyotes, and dogs are closely related species and are all canines? All three can interbreed. And just like dogs, coyotes are loyal, sensitive animals. Are you comfortable basically wearing dog fur? And despite what some people would have you believe, coyotes are not remotely as dangerous to your pets as traffic is. Every piece of fur trim came from an animal that did not want to die. Canada Goose humans are products of cruelty. And it's not just coyotes that are killed. You may have heard them claim that their down is, quote, ethically sourced. But nothing can be further from the truth. As Peter recently uncovered at a Canada Goose supplier, in video released by PETA, which you can watch behind me, geese are shown being crushed and suffocated. This supplier was not in China, but right here in Canada. This video of the Manitoba farm also shows workers rounding up panicked geese, grabbing and carrying them by their neck before cramming them into densely packed cages and shipping them off to slaughter. The investigation has led to a complaint being filed with the U.S. Federal Trade Commission and the Canadian Competition Bureau for deceiving customers regarding the welfare of geese used for their down. Down may be warm, but there are even warmer, cruelty-free alternatives. Primaloft, for example, was originally designed for the U.S. military. And unlike down, it retains its insulation even when wet. Another is OmniHeat, which has the highest heat retention per gram in the industry. Jackets made with this technology are very soft and down-like, but are made out of eco-friendly, cruelty-free material.
So what do you think of Canada Goose jackets, Jody? Are you sporting one of these trendy fashions on the streets of Vancouver? It only will cost you $900 to $1,200.
Oh, my gosh. I don't have that in my personal belongings, but I actually last night needed to borrow a jacket from a friend, and that's exactly what she handed me, was a down jacket with, I guess, coyote fur. Yeah. I had no idea that's, I was like, this might be raccoon dog fur.
Yeah, so that's a thing too in Vancouver, in Canada, we don't have stringent labeling laws, so actually there aren't any laws to say that you have to label this as real fur or not, so there's a lot of problems there as well. So I work at the University of BC campus, and I tell you, there are just so many fur-lined jackets with the fur trim. Most of them are Canada Goose jackets. Not all, I've noticed. I noticed there's other brands as well, and it just drives me insane. Yeah. So I really applaud the people that came down to the protests last week. I wanted to be there. I was sick, but Jillian, our co-host, was there, and I believe Jen was there as well. And from what I heard, they really did make an impact. It was called a light brigade, and they had letters on the steps of Robson Square that each person held, these really large life-size letters that said Canada Goose Kills. Mm-hmm. And as it got darker, those lights lit up and the letters lit up. And you know what Jillian told me? She said you could, because she was standing there on the steps, she said that you could see flashes of people running by in their Canada Goose jackets because they were shamed. Shameful. And wouldn't you? Because the whole purpose to wear these jackets is a status symbol, right?
Right.
That's the purpose because you don't need a $1,000 jacket to stay warm in Vancouver.
No.
Right?
That sounds insane. I had no idea they were that much too.
Yeah. Yeah. And that it goes up. It starts at $900, and that's here in Canada. And you don't need to wear that to be warm. You don't need to support. It's not like you have to be wearing that in order to survive in our tough winters of Vancouver, West Coast, BC. Yeah, I don't think so.
It's so ridiculous.
And there's alternatives, as the woman was saying there, and I'm always looking for alternatives myself, but to be realistic in Vancouver, you really don't need that. And anyways, I just find it interesting that these people that are usually so proud of their jackets, because I see them, right, on campus, and just, it really is, I remember being young. I remember wanting to wear name brands and as a, not a $1,000 name brands, but as a status symbol, right? And but I think the only way to tell people or to get young people, it seems to be younger people especially, but at least on well the campus where I work, it's all young people. But I think the only way to force people to stop wearing them is to shame them.
Yeah,
and like, those people were shamed.
Yeah, I find it interesting. Like if I bring this stuff up with friends, you can just hear their tone. Like, oh, they don't even want to know because then the guilt in having something that's so cruel.
Good.
People almost don't. They don't want to hear it because that's like you're saying. There's a shaming in the.
Yeah, PETA has done investigations. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I was watching a video last night, and it's actually really horrible. And this is what I intend to do: is I need to get that video on my phone so I can have have discreet conversations with students on campus and totally. Show them, because you're seeing them being skinned and they look like dogs. They're not wearing skin and they're not wearing their fur, I should say, and they don't have any skin on them. It looks horrible. And then people are putting these on they're wearing them. It's disgusting. Like you really there's a cognitive dissonance there.
Totally.
And we need to make fur history, and that is what is going to be done in San Francisco. So there was big news this week, and so I've got some great news here to share. So
that's good.
So a couple of days ago, animal rights activists rallied at San Francisco City Hall in support of a proposed ban on the sale of fur clothing and accessories. This would include those horrid Canada Goose jackets and such fur trims. And so as it appears, the city of San Francisco is only one step away from banning fur citywide. City Board Supervisor Katie Tang introduced a legislation in December, and she said this was inspired by similar bans passed in Berkeley and West Hollywood. San Francisco would be the largest city in the United States to adopt such legislation if it's approved. So they were supposed to have a vote on this a couple days ago this week, but they had some pushback from small businesses. So they put forward the following amendment, which is that instead of starting this year, the start date would be next January 2019. There will be no exception for nonprofits to sell fur. So unfortunately, that means that used fur will still be able to be sold in San Francisco. And the manufacturing of fur in San Francisco is also banned. So I don't know. I mean, San Francisco is a large city center, right? So it's gonna make a difference.
Yeah, and a fashion trendsetter.
Yeah, like exactly. So whatever San Francisco does, I mean, already led by West Hollywood, which is, you know, a smaller city, but San Francisco is big. So
great.
So I guess the negative part of the bill is that they will be able to still be able to sell used fur. But, you know, this is one step in the right direction. Earlier this month, Norway became the latest country to introduce a total ban on fur farming, joining Croatia, the Czech Republic, Germany, Japan, the United Kingdom, and others have taken steps to close fur farms. So soon, fur will be history.
That's amazing.
The moral baseline of our society is measured by its treatment of those most vulnerable within it. In Canada, no individuals are more vulnerable than non-human animals. They are defined as property under the Canadian Criminal Code, they lack recognition as contributing members of society, and their forms of communication are invalidated as of a lesser kind than human communication in normative social discourse. I wish I could tell you that those eloquently written words were my own, but they are not. They are the words of our feature interviewee, Jordan Reichert. I will be speaking to Jordan about the horse-drawn carriage tours in Victoria, which activists have wanted to put a stop to throughout the years. Jordan is the founder of the Victoria Horse Alliance and the West Coast Campaign Officer of the Animal Protection Party of Canada. Jordan, thank you for being on our show. I hope I got your introduction correct.
Yeah, thanks so much, Amir. Nice to be here.
Before we get into the pressing issue of the horse-drawn carriage tours, I wanted to do a miniature activist profile and ask you what brought you to this place in the world with your relationship with animals and animal rights.
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, you know, I think like so many advocates and activists out there, many years ago, I was touched by the film Earthlings, and really couldn't look back after that. I was watching it one night on a night shift at work, and I really didn't think anything of it at the time when I went to watch it. But then, Obviously, I was tremendously affected by it, and I remember, you know, sitting there at my computer and at work and being, you know, extremely emotional and realizing that, you know, my life would be different after this. And I remember going home the next few days and just realizing that, you know, the imagery and just all the sounds and everything had stayed with me. And so I decided that at that point, I wanted to validate my emotional awareness and hold myself accountable for the choices that I make that obviously harm other animals. And so I decided to go vegan, and then that was very shortly after, within the span of a few days, really. And then I decided that after that, that I wanted to do more than just go vegan, that that wasn't really enough for me, that there was something deeper, both philosophically, but also, I guess, existentially for me to do in this field. And so I decided to start creating content for animal activist and animal advocacy work in the community, and eventually that would lead to me progressing onwards into politics and the current animal advocacy that I do in the community.
That's pretty amazing, and it's kind of interesting how that movie Earthlings affects people differently, because I remember I was vegan at the time where me and my partner at the time introduced that movie to a bunch of friends of mine, and they didn't react to it the way you did, and our friendship kind of was forever changed by that experience, and it was kind of awkward after that, but it's amazing that it did that for you. So the issue with the horse-drawn carriage tours now, and a call for a ban in Victoria specifically, has been present for at least a couple years now. And before we get into the current state of the call for a ban, could you give our listener a bit of background on the issue and why you think it is important that we stop this so-called tradition?
Yeah, so you're right. This issue has been kind of present in the community for quite a number of years. I'd say at least a decade, really. Various people have worked on campaigns on the horse carriages, and I took it up about, I guess, three, four years ago. Mm-hmm. There was nobody working on the campaign, and it just kind of fallen to the wayside a bit. So myself and another activist in the community decided that, you know, this needed to still be addressed, and it needed to be addressed because obviously it's a focal point of how we treat animals in Victoria in many ways. When we have these exhibits or when we have these displays where animals are being controlled, mm-hmm. are being oppressed or being used for our amusement or entertainment, whether it's horse carriages, whether it's a zoo, or whether it's an aquarium or what have you, it kind of sets a standard in terms of how we perceive animals and what we accept as a society. And so when I see the horse carriages, I don't see the romantic notion of kind of the aristocracy or nobility that's often associated with these kind of romantic times, I suppose, and, you know, I guess queens and princes riding on in these carriages and such, that I think the carriage companies try to elicit from people. What I see is everything that went around that is attached to that, kind of beneath the surface. So, you know, one of the reasons, something I often say to people when they try to argue that it's tradition or that it's this kind of romantic notion, is if they realize that the reason the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the original SPCA, was actually started because of rampant horse abuse. Wow. In the UK at the time. And so it was because of that there was actually this impetus that we need to actually do something to protect these animals that are you know, pulling carriages, pulling, you know, goods and whatnot in our communities. And so, of course, it was conceptualized, I think, in a very different way. It was kind of similarly a very welfarist perspective of, you know, it's fine to use these animals, we just need to do it in a nicer way, I think, and that still persists today in a lot of ways. But, you know, for a lot of us, I think, as this movement has developed over the last 100 years, and, you know, obviously it has ancient roots if you want to go back that far, is that, you know, there's absolutely no reason, there's no rational excuse, and there's no moral excuse either in terms of why we should accept exploiting vulnerable animals who we have power over for profit in our society, or for any other reason at that matter. Especially, I mean, it is when you look at the horse carriages as an industry around the world, not just Victoria, and something else that I also encourage people to think about is that when you ride a horse carriage here in Victoria, even if you think the horse carriages here are not as bad as the horse carriages in Montreal or in New York or somewhere else, you're supporting that industry in those places as well.
Yeah, no.
You're kind of showing people that you support, you know, using horses in this way, that you support, you know, animals in general being used in this way. And so that's why it's important that we recognize it for what it is, and, you know, call it what it is as well. It's a very complicated issue to explain to the city, who are just primarily focused on profit and tourism.
Yeah.
But, you know, the underlying issues of exploitation, whether or not the horses are being severely mistreated or not, we may consider it inhumane to put horses in distressing situations on city streets, to put them in circumstances where their safety is compromised or where they may compromise the safety of the public. But, you know, as long as profit is driving these industries or the interest in tourism, the city tends to just kind of turn a blind eye to it and say, well, as long as there's nothing sort of grotesque taking place, we'll just accept it for what it is.
And I mean, on that note, a quote from a CTV article from earlier this month states, Victoria's horse carriage operators say recent allegations from the Victoria Horse Alliance should be put out to pasture. What sort of allegations were they talking about?
Well, I think at the time, we get numerous articles in the news quite frequently, actually, but one of them was that at the end of 2017, the horse carriage's rental contract with the City of Victoria had expired, and so it had been communicated to me by a representative of the city that they would not be able to operate until a new rental contract was agreed to with the city. Unfortunately, this wasn't the case, and I put out a press release saying that this was the case, and there was some confusion about that. And then, unfortunately, so in that, the city had decided to allow them to continue to operate even though their rental agreement had expired short periods of time. I mean, from our perspective, it was that you have this industry which is under intense public scrutiny, which we have brought, you know, numerous concerns forward to them. We've filed over a dozen cruelty complaints with the BCSPCA. We've filed numerous bylaw infractions with the City of Victoria themselves, and yet the city continues to take the position that in the last 5 years there's been nothing reported to them that would make them consider revoking the business license of the carriages. And so there seems to be sort of a bias in the communication of the city in terms of supporting the horse carriages and not really communicating at all that they have concerns, which they should be if they're doing their job, as far as I'm concerned.
Riding horses in general, that's come up on our show quite a bit, and I've always wondered, and so have other people that work on the show, if there is ever a time when riding horses or using them in this way isn't inherently cruel.
Well, I think you have to look at it in a larger social context. So, I mean, am I going to say that it is inherently cruel to ride a horse, in the sense that you have these animals that in many cases have been, you know, there's horses that's been their whole lives.
Yeah.
And so I'm not going to say that it's necessarily cruel to get on the back of that horse that has become habituated to that. However, is the actual action something that is, in a larger context, beneficial to that animal in terms of what does it establish when you get on the back of that horse? Because that action is actually extremely political. That action is extremely loaded in terms of its consequences for that animal. So when you get on the back of a horse, are you actually kind of saying, well, you know, the oppression and domination of these animals is acceptable because I want to kind of participate in horseback riding. You know, a horse, a wild horse, or a feral horse wouldn't let you ride on their back,
right?
unless you broke them first.
Yeah, I was going to get to that term, breaking a horse. You know that.
Yeah, that's right. Of their will to you know, be independent, right? But not be controlled. I mean, they're flight animals, so it doesn't make any sense for us to do that. Obviously, it was done as a mode of transportation and of maybe economic value. But in terms of it being something good for the horses first, no, I don't see that. Yeah. And that goes back to the same argument that we hear with so many things, is people say, well, you know, if horses aren't doing something for us, then there aren't going to be any horses, right? Then they're going to go extinct, and so that's a greater crime, they often say. Just like they say with, you know, what if we didn't have cows and chickens and things like that? Well, what would cows and chickens do? I mean, they would just go extinct, and people forget, you know, that we created, unfortunately, this situation where we have these animals that are their existence is defined only by their dependence upon us, and that's I think. Dependency and domestication is perhaps one of the greatest sort of crimes inflicted upon, I guess, the natural world.
Yeah, that's a really great point. You probably heard about it, but we just had a major victory in Vancouver with cetaceans in captivity no longer being allowed at the Vancouver Aquarium. And a huge part of that was direct action from activists in Vancouver. Has there been much direct action in your eyes in Victoria in regards to the horse-drawn tours?
Yeah, so, I mean, we've spent years walking, doing, you know, for example, in December, the Downtown Victoria Business Association sponsors these trolley tours where essentially they're just two horse trolleys that lumber around the city during kind of one of the busiest shopping times of the year, the holiday season. And they just give free tours. People can hop on, hop off at various locations. And so we follow them around with signs. You know, we just walk alongside on the opposite side of the road so that everybody can see that there's opposition to the horse carriages. We do outreach with the public, of course, and we actually get a tremendous amount of public support from people. And we also document, of course. And so that's been kind of a primary focus of our work, is that whenever we go out, we don't simply go and you know, hold signs, and that's fine, right? It's definitely an important part of raising awareness and activism. But we always, you know, I've made it a priority to document everything that we see, everything that is done with the horse carriages and horse trolleys. And by doing so, we're able to make legitimate complaints both to the SPCA and to the city about what is objectively taking place. So it's fine if people want to take an oppositional stance to us and say that, you know, they think the horse carriages are pretty, or that they, you know, tourists like them, or that kind of thing, kind of anecdotal statements. But for us to have objective evidence of concerns and be able to raise those with, you know, those with specific powers, such as the city or the SPCA,
right,
then, you know, we can firmly establish that there's, you know, good cause for us to be taking up our position, that there's good cause for us for there to be concern. And I think the reputation of the carriage companies has been greatly diminished because of the tremendous both video and image documentation that we've applied to them over the last couple of years to show that all is not well with this industry the way that people once thought it was.
Yeah. Is there anything our listener can do to help the cause, even though it's in Victoria and Vancouver? Obviously, we're not too far apart, but is there anything that, if our listeners listening to this interview can do to help put this to an end?
Yeah, so if people want to get involved at all, you know, the best thing you can do right now is write to the City of Victoria. If you just go to their website, you can contact the mayor and council, and you can just let them know that you do not support this industry. Certainly, organizations are welcome to, you know, add their voice to that. We highly encourage organizations to show their support, whether they're from Vancouver or anywhere. Let them know that as a visitor to Victoria, you hate seeing that, that there's many concerns that you're worried about, and, you know, also say, you know, that you don't really feel comfortable coming to Victoria. Yeah. when you see the horse carriages, it's kind of a disgrace. And so we definitely encourage tourists or visitors to communicate that to the city.
Again, Jordan, we don't have much time left. I just want to say that it was a pleasure speaking with you, and I think you're the right person to have as one of the front runners for this cause.
Yeah, thank you so much, Amir. I really appreciate the time on the show.
This is your big chance, so don't blow it. We're here to present the cutting-edge radio you want to hear. What about a program featuring just local Vancouver bands?
No market for that.
We have an expert on gospel music.
No.
Our public affairs programs dig deep with voices other stations won't touch.
No.
Programs with First Nations hosts?
Sorry, no market for that.
We've got a lot of shows in other languages for people all over the world. Folk music?
You're kidding, right? Who would sponsor that?
Can't make big bucks with programs people want to hear? You have to go to Co-op Radio for that. Community-owned radio. Now at 100.5 FM. The switch is on.
So you're listening to Animal Voices here on 100.5 FM, CFRO, Vancouver Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada, and we have some events for you. So next week, we've been talking about all kinds of animal exploitation today. First, we started with fur coats and horse carriages. Have you ever thought about kangaroos, Jody?
No.
Kangaroos are being exploited as well. We just don't see it very much here because they're in Australia and we're here in Canada. But we are bringing the plight of the kangaroos to Vancouver, and that's happening next week. So there will be a film screening of a new film called Kangaroo. It's next Sunday, February the 4th at 3 p.m. at the Vif Van City Theatre, and our own co-host, Jen Dobell, will be moderating this event. So that should be interesting. And then we're going to be having an interview with one of the filmmakers on next week's show as well. So here's an event that's coming up, and this is happening in February. So have you heard, I'm going to ask you this, Jody, because I know you've signed up for the Facebook event, but have you heard of the Day of Giving Without Arbitrary Borders, part three?
No.
Okay, you have indicated on Facebook that you know about this. So this is an event that some friends and I have started last year, and it's all vegan. It started as a counterpoint to tone ignorant nationalistic focus on July 1st, 2017. You know, we celebrate Canada Day, and we're proud of Canada, but yet we ignore marginalized communities, especially here in the downtown east side, which is actually right where our radio station is located. We're a community radio station as well, right? So we're part of this community. So what we have done now, like we did this on July 1st, and we did it last year on Labor Day weekend, and we're going to be doing it again this time on February 11th and 12th, we're going to be making lots of vegan hot meals again. This time our aim is to feed 600 people. Wow. Because, and this is double, I think we did 300 last time, and the food was given out, and it was very appreciated. Mm-hmm. And this is being spearheaded by David Isbister, who is a wonderful vegan caterer here in Vancouver, and lots of other people as well. I've been helping with it. And yeah, so I just want to say there's lots more I could say about it, but check our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, to find out more information about this. If you want to help, we need help with cash donations, donations of personal toiletry items, and donations of your time to help make this food, which will be happening on the weekend of February 10th, 11th, and 12th, and then giving out the food those days. So if you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced in the show, please post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, or you can send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com.
As some of our listeners may know, I use online dating websites as a platform for animal advocacy. I refer to this as Tindervism because I mainly use Tinder for my activism. So I never expect to meet any vegan guys on there, but recently I was surprised to come across Rob, a 33-year-old gentleman from Toronto, now living in Victoria. We've become friends, and today Rob Carruthers joins us to talk about life as a single vegan father of three who started doing Tindervism as well. Welcome, Rob.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's really neat to have this perspective because usually we're talking to parents of vegan kids who are females and they're dealing with their exes who are not vegan males. But this is a unique perspective, a vegan male. It's kind of a rare thing, and especially a vegan male raising three kids. So I just want you to share your experiences with us. Let's begin with how you began the vegan lifestyle and what caused you to take this transformation in your life.
Well, I've been vegan for 2 years, and before that I was pescatarian for almost 10 years. And I got to that point just from learning about animals and animal welfare and becoming more and more concerned and becoming more and more educated on the fact that I just do not need to be a part of it.
Yeah, how were you first exposed to the truths behind what happens to animals? Because most of us are quite shielded from that information unless somebody shows it to us, right?
Yeah, exactly. So for me, it was MySpace before Facebook. Somebody had posted a PETA video, and I checked it out, and it was really interesting. So I just started looking into it, and I started making changes, not supporting these factory farms, and it got to the point where I eventually became vegan.
Awesome. And so you're a part-time father of three kids. How old are they?
The kids are 4, 7, and 9.
And how does veganism affect your parenting?
Well, besides the obvious challenges of like birthday parties and whatnot, I mean, it's just a matter of constantly being there for them and providing them with healthy options and their, you know, tofu and beans and all the great proteins at home. And if they are at a party and they're not having burgers, they can have the veggies that are there, and I can explain to the parents that they will have what they need when they get home, or I can supply something. And sometimes the parents will provide something for them. But the challenges are, like, you face a lot of criticism from parents, and I've had friends say that they're not sure that I should be raising children as vegans. So I stand my ground and I say, well, listen, like, here are some examples of people raised vegan, and I think that it's a healthy way to do it. And I actually think it's unhealthy to feed them what, you know, what people say a normal diet would be. To me, that's just scary.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even begin to think about how much deli meat I ate throughout my entire childhood. That was my school lunch staple.
Right.
With bread and butter. And I mean, I did have, you know, carrot sticks and apples, but a lot of deli meat, that causes cancer.
Definitely. I mean, and we should be careful too. One of my kids likes processed food and he likes the fake deli meats and stuff. So he can have that because it's fairly reasonable as far as the ingredients. And he still gets to enjoy those delicious sandwiches at times, but for the most part, we eat a healthy, you know, raw diet.
Whole foods kind of diet. That's awesome. Have any of the parents, after maybe initially criticizing or questioning you, seen what your kids are actually eating and how healthy they look and said, hey, maybe there's something to this. Can you tell me a little more? I'm interested.
I've had parents, especially colleagues at work who are parents, other men at work, ask me about it because their kids have expressed to them that they're interested in like a vegetarian or vegan diet. So I would share some resources to them. So yes, sometimes, you know, by speaking up a little bit at work or with other parents, you do get some questions and I can provide some feedback. And, you know, even if they just change their diet a little bit, that's good. It's a step in the right direction for sure.
That's awesome. I'm glad that they have you to ask, because maybe you're the only parent in the class who has this lifestyle. I mean, it is still kind of a minority, unfortunately, that we have vegans out there.
Definitely. My kids actually search their schools for other vegans, and they like will come and report back to me once in a while that they're the only vegans in school. And my son was recently excited because he had a new student in his class and she was vegetarian, so he found that was exciting, having someone with some common ground.
Wow. Does he try to veganize her?
I'm not sure how he does with the girls. He's a little shy, I think. So.
Elementary schoolism.
Yeah, but they are getting into activism a little bit. They're handing out leaflets, like we have cards, and they have all the links to different documentaries, and they'll hand them out, and people actually will take them from them a lot easier than they will from me.
Oh, when I do activism, I get old people and children to do the leafleting because nobody's going to be rude to those people of those age groups. I've just noticed it.
Yeah. It's effective. Sure.
It is. I mean, no one's going to say no to a cute little kid. Your kids are the cutest I've ever seen. So
thanks.
I think they'll be very effective.
We were walking around this weekend and they're targeting people with dogs. Like, that's how smart my kids are. They're like, handing out the cards. They're like, do you want to learn about animals?
Oh,
and they're
handing
out these like little cards with links to documentaries about animals, essentially, right?
That's awesome.
But, yeah, it is. It's great.
So does this present any challenges co-parenting since your ex is not vegan?
It does. So we've moved here from Toronto and there was a chain that had vegan pizza and it was very easy to get. It was somewhat new there, but they did have it. And she was getting used to that once or twice a week, ordering that vegan pizza, and she would get the regular pizza because she's not vegetarian or vegan. And so now here I've heard some complaints and it's just a matter of me saying, well, I'm sorry, but you know, I keep the lines of communication open and friendly. And I try to be kind when I say, well, if you need me to drop off a vegan pizza, I have no problem doing that. And maybe she'll realize in that, you know, it's easy enough for her to just provide a healthy option instead.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely a lot of challenges, but in order to keep co-parenting functional, we just move forward and I just try and be kind.
That's good. And so let's talk about you in the workplace. You work as a foreman in the trades industry. You're a carpenter. It's not known to be the most vegan friendly or even politically correct environment. There's a lot of racism, homophobia, macho attitudes. So what's it like for you being vegan in that kind of a workplace, especially being a male vegan?
It's interesting. I feel that I have that niche covered. So what I do is I will discuss it with people and when I can. But right off the bat, like, they might notice that my boots look different because I don't have leather boots anymore. And my pouches are never leather. So I do appear to be a little bit different. They might not realize why. And running up and down the stairs, I can do that all day long. And these guys are stopping on the fifth floor, and I'm up at the 10th floor, and I'm ready to go to work. I don't need a break. So I feel that I can represent veganism very well at work. And it's actually perhaps a great place to plant some seeds, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you have meals together sometimes. How does that go?
Well, it can be awkward at times when, like, I've had friends who have actually died of heart attacks. And one of them specifically, he and I would discuss veganism versus his, like, hardcore meat-eating diet a lot at lunch. And when he passed, I had a lot of friends from the trade call and remind me how I had warned him about, you know, his condition of, you know, like what he was doing was going to cause a heart attack. And I asked him as a friend to change his lifestyle. So, yeah, I mean, it can get pretty intense out there. Some of these guys, these rough and tough guys, they think that meat is macho. And if I can break down some of those just false pretenses to what being macho really is, then, and it's the perfect place to do it, really.
Yeah, there still is kind of that attitude. I'm glad that you're able to represent veganism in the environment that you do. It's great.
Yeah.
So what you got into activism kind of recently, right? I mean, you've been a vegan for a while, but haven't done any activism. Is that correct?
That's correct. Besides, like, the kids handing out the cards, like, even that's a recent thing. And as you pointed out, like, I can do a lot with the kids, and I don't need to make excuses. I'm sick of making excuses about not being an activist, because I think it's activism that helps me so much, and it's time to pay it forward, so to speak. Like at the Toronto Pig Save, I constantly would see that online, and these pigs, they were so thirsty. They just wanted to drink the water. People would feed them water, and it just inspired me. You know what? I should be there. Like, I want to give these pigs water. If it's the last refreshing thing that they get before going into this system, this industry, it's just maybe something little that I did just for that one animal. But beyond that, I mean, helping people, I mean, showing people what's going on, and it helps, I think. So now I'm devoted to getting my boots on the ground and actually being an activist. And I don't care how busy I am. I'm going to do it for sure. I'm motivated to do that.
That's awesome. And just for our listeners who might not know what the SAVE movement is, Rob was talking about Toronto Pig SAVE specifically. The SAVE movement is where activists gather outside slaughterhouses where the trucks are bringing the animals in, and they're minutes away from slaughter. And it's in all weather conditions across Canada. So you can imagine the stifling heat in Toronto in the summertime. And these pigs, I believe it's 52 hours or more that they're legally allowed to be transported without breaks, food, or water. And they come in and they're foaming at the mouths, and they are so thirsty. They're panting so much that their mouths are curled up at the sides. And that's what Rob was talking about there. The SAVE movement is one of the many, many forms of activism that's taking place all over the world right now. And this is a growing movement of animal rights activism.
Definitely. I've seen trucks with cows in them where the cows are bleeding out the back of the truck because they're rubbing up against the steel trucks.
Oh, yeah.
It is something that I think is an effective way to show people just how brutal it is, the industry is.
Yeah, for sure. They get videos taken there and they put it up on Facebook and YouTube, and next thing you know, the meat eaters are seeing them. Lots of effective forms of activism. You came over to Vancouver for a TV Outreach for Animals event right after I met you. For those who don't know what that is, we had a giant movie screen set up. We were showing undercover footage of what happens in slaughterhouses, and activists were on the ground passing out leaflets to the public just below the screen. And so you took part in that. What did you think about it?
I thought it was great, and I really liked how that was specifically geared towards vegetarians, because it was showing the dairy industry and the egg industry. So not only would it just show cruelty in general towards animals, so we could just help veganize everybody, but specifically the excuse people where, well, I'm doing what I can, but I just gotta have that cheese. Well, you know what, that's the same. It really is. And when you actually confront that fact and make that change, you'll feel better.
Mm-hmm.
You will.
Yeah, heads out of the sand, everybody. Look it up on YouTube. It's not hard to find that information out there. So you used to hunt and fish, and it's really been hard for me to find some guy that used to hunt and fish to come out and say, I don't do it anymore, and here's why. So here you are. I finally found the guy, and I've wanted to have this person on the radio forever. So thank you. Tell us your story. How did you have this change of heart around hunting and fishing?
Well, basically, I grew up hunting birds. My dad and I would have 12-gauge shotguns and all sorts of multiple rifles, and we would sneak up on ducks, which I'm not sure you need to do, because ducks are pretty friendly, but we would sneak up on them and shoot them. And I remember one of the first times where I actually had to go fetch the ducks myself, because my dad asked me to. I don't think he felt like walking in the water that day. I remember looking down at this mallard with that, you know, beautiful green neck and the colors, and just, they're just fantastic, such a beautiful bird. And I didn't really feel comfortable picking up the dead animal, but I did it because I was being pushed to do so. And I just, I'll never forget how soft it was and how cute it was. And I picked it up and I felt uncomfortable carrying it around by its neck. And it honestly, it didn't take more than two or three times before that feeling kind of went away. And I became just this rough and tough hunting boy. Now, what I find interesting about that is that I actually would clean and eat the meat. And I would actually be encouraged. I mean, people, it would sound like my dad was bragging when he would tell people about how I killed a pheasant. You know, like the story behind when Rob pulled the pheasant out of the car and finished it off. Like, it was some sort of, you know,
like a triumph.
Macho thing.
Yeah. And
yeah, so it took a while for me. I didn't follow up with hunting when I became a young adult. And I considered possibly getting into hunting at times, but it seemed like a big fuss, and I didn't really actually get down to it. And by the time I was in my early 20s, I started to learn about, you know, what was actually going on with animals and just kind of going in a different direction. So, but it was the fishing that also was pretty big. You want to hear about that?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, growing up fishing with all my male father figures, like my stepdad, my dad, my uncles, my grandpa, I just always fished. Right? Whether or not I was cleaning the fish and eating it or just sport fishing, it was just always a part of my life. And this is actually, even as a pescatarian, up until just years ago, I was fishing. And I started getting fishing charters in Florida, bass fishing all the time. And I would watch the fish. I had polarized sunglasses. I would watch the fish at the shoreline and just see how they had their own groups of bass. And sometimes they were working with the birds. And I could see that they had a lot going on. There was some, it's almost like a community of fish down there. And they work together or chase, you know, hunt together, perhaps. And also, to catch them, you have to have these incredibly detailed, fancy lures to outsmart them half the time. And the other half the time, they're just super impulsive and they'll just go and bite whatever it is that you drop in front of them because they're just random. And that reminds me of people. Like, people will work together and do these amazing things together and build incredible things. And then other times, they're just completely independent and impulsive. So I could really see that these fish were, you know, very intelligent. And I didn't like catching them with bad damage on them from other hooks or other fishermen. It just made me feel uncomfortable. And then sometimes it would swallow the hook, or you would lose the hook on the fish and it swims away with the hook. So there were so many times when, you know, I would feel guilty.
Yeah.
And because I knew how intelligent was, that the final straw was in a fishing charter in the ocean when we caught a moray eel. The thing was absolutely incredible and beautiful, and it died on the line. And that was, I believe, the last time I went fishing, because I said, no, this is wrong. This is too damaging.
Yeah, if anyone hears what you just said and they continue to fish and hunt, I don't know what more to say to them. I mean, that almost had me in tears.
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't believe that it took, I'm ashamed that it took me that long to come to that conclusion. But I think that just goes to show how powerful the I don't know, traditions or brainwashing is.
Yeah.
And I think that people, if maybe I can help, if they hear me and say that I got through it and stopped doing it, maybe they can stop too. And you can still be tough. You can still be cool and a man and macho and have, you know, all these muscles and be vegan.
Well, that was such a good story. We only have a couple minutes left, but I do want to ask you definitely, what is it like to date as a vegan male? What are the responses like from women? Because typically it's vegan women in the dating world with men who are sort of hardened, like the men that you just described. And typically women are the more sensitive, compassionate, maternal gender. So tell us, what is it like dating as a vegan male?
Well, as a vegan male dating recently, I'm learning the ropes. I'm learning about myself as to whether or not I can date someone who isn't vegan. Women will ask me, is it okay that they're not vegan? And generally, I will say, yeah, it's okay, because I want to go on a date with them, get to know them. Perhaps I'm thinking that they will be vegan someday. There's a lot of typical challenges where just working around these first dates, really. And also, I'm using something where you talked about Tinderism, where now I'm kind of using it as a little bit of outreach in itself, where I not only am I asking women questions based on getting to know them, but I'm asking them questions to try and help educate them. And a lot of the times they understand already. For women, I think that compassion isn't as uncommon, and they actually tend to agree with most of everything I say. So in a way, they're already halfway there and they're close. So maybe it's a good place for me to do outreach, because they're, you know, more likely to actually listen.
Great. Well, we're all out of time here. It's been really interesting talking with you. I'd love to have you back on again further down the road when you've been doing a bit more activism for a while, and see where you're at then.
Cool. Sounds good.
Okay, Rob. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our show next Friday, February the 2nd, 2018. We will have a feature interview with Mick McIntyre. He's the director of the film called Kangaroo, which is debuting in Vancouver next week. It's about the issues of slaughter and exploitation facing kangaroos. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. You can go to animalvoices.org and you can stream shows there or download the shows as podcasts. You can also subscribe to us via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. To end the show today, we have a song called American Horse by The Cult. Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.